Omnibus is a production of iHeartRadio.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 515.SS0611, certificate number 17086, the Garden of Earthly Delights. Is this an episode about my house?
It is. It's about the Omnibus Bunker, which we have turned into a future paradise with our little set that can be chess and checkers, or if you turn it upside down, backgammon. One of the reasons we started this endeavor is because we've both been worried about maybe the ephemeral nature of the cloud, not the...
The cloud, you mean?
The cloud. It has an umlaut? No? I keep all my data in German servers.
I always say it in a Scottish accent.
Oh, it's
the cloud.
Like the MacLeod.
The MacLeods.
The MacLeods of Loch MacLeod.
The reason is that when I first heard of the cloud many, many years ago.
It was an old Scots farmer.
It was explained to me by a Scot. And I was like, the what? And he was like, the cloud.
Imagine if your sex ed teacher was Irish. And for the rest of your life, you're like, spermatozoa. I just thought it was said that way.
I did have a teacher in college who said encyclopedia as encyclopedia.
Like he said the extra.
He actually insisted that the little, the grafted letters, which we've covered on Omnibus, he insisted that they be pronounced.
He's got a serious case of diuresis.
And so for a long time, I did say like encyclopedia.
Obviously, that's what all the educated people say.
A lot of people refer to our pronunciations and specifically my pronunciations with a lot of frustration. But, you know, they all have a backstory.
And also, they've all caught on in the future.
That's like, right.
Before we went on, you were pronouncing realtor, realtor. If you had done that on mic, you would have changed the future, but you didn't. So now people are still saying realtor like.
Realtor, that's what I do. I say that still.
Realtor.
Realtor.
Because they sell.
Real estate.
Real estate.
Real estate. Yeah, they do sell real estate.
And we're one of the reasons why we're worried about the cloud is because people don't have physical stuff anymore. We don't carve things that are important to us into stone tablets and keep them in our house. We just trust that vast corporations will be benevolent enough to let us keep looking at our vacation photos,
right,
or watching the pornography that we've purchased. No, not even that, but
collected in files.
Like the, you know, if I have every season of Will and Grace digitally, at some point, some company will be like, no, you cannot have every season of Will and Grace. And at that point, how much language would get lost if not just to us, but to humanity, if everybody lost their digital footprint, if something terrible were to happen?
We see it all the time, that something that is free, something that we used to own, then becomes something held for us by our benevolent cloud. And then eventually some money is attached to it. Like, oh, now you have to pay 99 cents a month, or now you have to pay $100 a year. And pretty soon it will be, oh, you want your vacation photos? Well, here's what you need.
And there's an algorithm that prices each one. Your right. Wife looks very good in this swimsuit. This photo is $8.
Well, it'll be tied to like, If your credit rating dips below 650,
photos just start disappearing.
It's so bogus.
It's the Back to the Future will be real. Yeah. Like, people will start fading out of photos if the future goes badly.
Did we talk about this on our show? I have a family member who works as Paul Allen's librarian.
I think she has come up before, yes.
And only recently, just in the last week or two, she has expressed that as part of dealing with his estate, like his estate now is obviously like billions of dollars and tons of real estate.
This is a recently deceased Microsoft billionaire and sports team owner for the future.
But she, as his librarian, is trying to deal with his incredible, what she called multiple petabytes of media that he has accumulated.
Ooh, you should always make sure you delete all your petabytes.
Because here comes Petabear. She said the problem is none of this digital media is transferable. No one can inherit it. It cannot be disseminated. And so we have these petabytes of just libraries upon libraries across all media, but we can't do anything with it.
There are certain kinds of intellectual property law that keep him from transferring the rights to his
It's just heirs. Like if it's on iTunes, it doesn't belong to him to give. The other person, you know, whoever he gifted it to would also have to buy it on iTunes. I mean, it's as simple as that. If it exists on discs, it's not, you don't possess the physical media. You possess the right to it.
That's why having a basement full of VHS tapes is now, it's not a hipster style choice or even I've given up on life and need to go to Value Village choice. It really is an act of libertarian.
Yeah. I mean,
rebellion and patriotism.
You were bragging to me the other day that you had all these DVDs, walls of DVDs. And in fact, you own those things.
I'm going to have the only copy of the Disney movie, The One and Only Genuine Original Family Band, once Disney, Fox, Lucas, Marvel decides that movie is canceled.
They put it behind a paywall or they put it behind a double triple paywall.
Double triple paywall.
Yeah. But anyway, my librarian relative was truly lamenting that school libraries are dumping media and putting everything online. She's like, no, don't do it. Keep all hard media because of this ephemerality.
I've said this before, but if you are writing if you have to go deep on a serious topic, which I have had to do as a writer, not as a podcaster.
No.
For this, Wikipedia is fine.
Yeah, we don't go that deep.
But if you really need to go deep, you will be in a university library for weeks, and I don't know what would happen if that went away, because there's some kind of naive assumption, I think, by people my kids' age that everything just got moved to the internet. And almost nothing got moved to the internet. So imagine a civilization-wide version of this where people are trying to figure out who Gary Coleman was, and they have like four records.
What are you talking about, Willis?
Is that what you would say to them? I have traveled.
And they wouldn't even get it.
I have traveled to your era to tell you, what you talking about, future Willis? And this is actually something that happens to us. And so it's terrifying vision of the future. If people are, imagine all these future detectives trying to be like, we believe there were four Kardashians, but some wise men say there were five, But this is actually what happens in our day when we look back at records from, say, the Renaissance, people for whom there were not, if somebody left behind no letters or writings, we just have very scattered views of their lives.
Thank God for the diaries of Samuel Pepys.
Exactly. was he a realtor?
He was a member of a very vibrant London alternative sex community.
Yeah, they would get together every night in the Lyceum or the Athenaeum and look at each other's peepees.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was fine.
And perform hot Carls.
It wasn't even gay, actually.
No.
It was just something everyone did.
Yeah.
So there were tons of people like that did keep journals, and it's a treasure trove to us because we might not know what the London fish market looked like if not for Samuel Pepys going there one day. Or
we should start a podcast that tries to preserve this ephemera for future generations.
They would thank us, I think, if we would just stop dinking around talking about whatever, talking about the way to pronounce realtor. And actually preserve some knowledge. And a good example of a kind of person for whom we just have no information because he did not leave journals or sketchbooks or writings of any kind is the Netherlandish Northern Early Renaissance painter Hieronymus Bosch.
How is that possible? We are all very familiar with Hieronymus Bosch.
Hieronymus Bosch's best works are iconic today. Museums make and they're in the public domain. Some museums and sketchy Etsy outfits make millions every year selling socks and ties. And like elaborate porcelain versions of some of his surreal visions. If you want to have that on your mantelpiece next to your Dungeons and Dragons giant wagon.
Do I ever. I love my giant wagon.
You've got your chainmail elves and whatnot lined up in your campaign ready to go.
Mithril. Or mithril.
It's not mithril like mythos?
I don't know. I always said mithril, but like myth. M-Y-T-H is not pronounced meath.
Right. Yeah. No, I've always said mithril as well when I have the opportunity to say it.
I'm sure somebody's
which is never nerd. I do like that.
If you don't say mithril at least once every 6 months, then you're not living.
This is a digression on a digression, but I kind of like the way they overpronounce all these things in the Peter Jackson Lord of the Rings movies. Like, it's not mithril, it's mithril.
Mithril.
Like, the elves would have said the clear L. It's mithril.
Oh,
so
course.
These poor actors have to be like, Galadriel. I'm sure actors hate doing that kind of affected thing, so they must have hated it.
But Hieronymus Bosch is like, he's like the proto-Dolly. He's iconic. He is hallucinogenic. He's horrifying.
Have you ever ingested him?
I don't, you know, a lot of that stuff I blacked out.
Little Mummy Brown.
Actually, I never blacked out. Can you believe that? And all the drugs.
Good for you.
Yeah, I wasn't a blacker outer.
And even podcasting?
No, this is all just, it's a huge hole in my brain.
I have no idea what's happening right now.
Spongiform encephalitis.
Hieronymus Bosch is, we don't even know what his paintings were called. Even, we're probably wrong about his name. I mean, his name was actually Hieronymus? He was quite Hieronymus. He was, what's the Dan Savage word? Monogamish. He was monogamish.
Oh, he was monogamish.
No, he was not monogamish. We don't know. We don't know anything about him.
There are no records, no census. I mean,
there's a handful. Like, we don't know what year he was born because there's no birth record from the church.
Wait, the Dutch are extremely meticulous about this kind of thing.
He was from the town of Sertogenbosch. And I'm almost certainly saying that wrong because we love
Sertogenbosch.
We love to mispronounce Dutch words.
I think it is
the omnibus.
I think it is Sertogenbosch.
But the funny thing about it is it starts with an apostrophe.
Yes.
Then there's a small s.
Yes.
Then there's a hyphen. Then there's a capital H because the Dutch are naming their town, and the town fathers are like, I'm sorry, I must have one number, one special character.
I think the apostrophe s is pronounced tst.
Is that right? It's a shortening of des, like the. Like, yeah. They've just shortened the article.
I've actually played a concert in Sertogenbosch.
No.
Not once, but multiple times.
Really?
Yeah.
And do you have any impressions of this is a found gem to me that you actually have firsthand experience of Sertogenbosch. Do you remember anything about it?
I do remember a lot about it, and it is one of what I consider kind of the hidden gems of the Netherlands. It's not like a big stop on the tourist train, but it has a lot of history there. There was a lot of contention over the ownership of Sertogenbosch back in the historical times. This was an area of the Netherlands that traded hands a lot.
Right.
And it's it's an extremely charming little city, and I have extremely fond memories of playing there.
In the late 15th century, in Bosch's era, Sertogenbosch was part of the duchy. I think we say duchy on the omnibus.
Yeah.
At your request.
Yeah, we passed the duchy down the left-hand side.
The duchy of Brabant. It was Habsburg territory. But it was not, unlike places where a lot of artists came from, it was not a royal court of any kind. It was not a university town. It was just a nice middle-class, you know, merchant town that made organs. It made church bells. There was a big foundry there for bells. They made knives.
They call it Den Bosch.
Yeah, for short.
Yeah, it's the Bosch.
I guess that means the forest of the forest. Yeah. It's the Duke's forest,
yeah.
Basically. Just like saying, what is it in French? The Bosque, the Bois. The Bois de Boulogne.
Bois de Boulogne.
The Bois in France, or the Bosque in Spain, or the Bosque in Italy. It was the Duke's forest. The Duke didn't live there. That's just where he kept his forest.
Sure. It's just like Liechtenstein or Liechtenstein, which is a country where the owners, the Liechtensteinian family, never had been to Liechtenstein.
It was essentially a storage locker.
Yeah, it was just like the Liechtenstein family's forest.
They're like, we'll give you number 8. And they're like, no, we have a lot of stuff. And they're like, we'll give you this small country.
What about this forest? And they were like, meh, all right.
So the only time we have records of Bosch is, you know, every 20 years we'll get a glimpse of him. Oh, here he is. He's apparently in a family of 3. His brother's also a painter. And then it'll be 20 years later. Oh, he's married now. And the local brotherhood wants him to do a stained glass window for them.
Right.
He was one thing that Sertogen Bosch was a center of was a kind of a local religious revival. There was a local brotherhood and sisterhood.
A brethren or a cistern?
Yeah, they would have a cistern to drain everything.
To drain
the brethren.
To throw witches into.
You got to have a cistern to drain the brethren.
It's a very swampy part of the Netherlands.
No matter what we talk about, you're convinced that it's a swamp. I love this about the omnibus now.
Pretty sure. Anywhere in the world I can find a swamp. Just give me 20 minutes.
Like we'll be talking about the McKinley assassination. You'll be like, it was quite swampy on the expo grounds that day.
Well, Washington, D.C., very swampy. Built on a swamp.
That's true. Still swampy to this day, unless we drain it. So the local brotherhood was kind of a lay group devoted to bringing kind of common religion back. They were really influenced by Thomas Kempis's Imitatio Christi, like, oh, this is what Jesus really would have done.
Right.
He wouldn't have had all these basilicas. He would have lived his life like this. So it's a very religious part of the country.
Well, it is, but it's a contentious, I hate to get all like into the Kingdom of the Orange.
Let's do it. Who was fighting over Den Bosch?
Well, for a long time, you know, the Netherlands were a hotbed of Calvinism, but of course the Habsburgs were Catholics. Mm-hmm. And the Habsburgs controlled a lot of Belgium and the Netherlands during this whole period, sort of 30 years war era. And so this Sertogenbosch was this contended for area because it was Catholic for a long time after the Calvinists were pretty well established in that part of Europe. So a lot of the fighting was, well, you know, religious fighting, the best kind.
Religion would have permeated every aspect of life back then, which is what makes kind of the eccentricity of Bosch's canvases very, even more surprising than they would be to modern eyes. We have no evidence, by the way, that Bosch ever left his hometown.
Where were these paintings? They seem super heretical, seem like the type of thing the church would embrace.
His most famous works look like altarpieces. They are these big triptychs like the Heywane or the Last Judgment or the Garden of Earthly Delights. So they look like altarpieces, but you're absolutely right. Because of the content of them, they would have been extremely unusual in any church. And we know that not long after Bosch's death, I think 1 year after his death, we have a record finally that the Garden of Earthly Delights is being displayed in a town palace in Brussels. So it would have been private owners, you know, wealthy, rich and wealthy entitled men wanting something nice for their home theater because they don't have a flat screen TV.
But these are not something nice.
They are beautiful, but certainly eccentric. There's a lot going on. Think about a world where you don't have, you know, movies or other kind of dense transporting media, no video games. Maybe you do want wall art with a lot going on.
Well, that's it. And to futurelings who may not have direct access to these paintings, they're unlike a lot of paintings of the era where there's a kind of central character or, you know, the Night Watch, it's a identifiable faces and a pretty limited story within the paintings. And this is like, I mean, there are 25 visible episodes, maybe 50 individual stories being told.
And they are incredibly mysterious to us, even today. In a lot of ways, they're outsider art, really. I mean, oil painting would only have been 100 years old when he made these. So a lot of techniques like linear perspective have, you know, not really even been perfected or invented yet. So he's not part of any recognizable school. He is painting what's interesting to him in a way that kind of has incredible detail and a lot of psychological depth, apparently, when you just look at the figures and their faces and what they're doing. But it's not even clear what there's a reference to. You know, his most famous triptych we call the Garden of Earthly Delights, but that's not a name that Bosch would have referred to it. Before the 18th century, when the public could go to galleries and see art, when it was just being bought by wealthy collectors or who commissioned them, wealthy patrons, paintings didn't really have names given to them by the artists. The first time this is ever given a name, I think the Garden of Earthly Delights is in, I think King Philip of Spain, it appears in a catalog of his goods, and it's called La Pintura del Madroño, the painting of the strawberry tree, because strawberries figure into it. It's related to the Madrona tree we have in the Pacific Northwest with its papery red bark.
So this was just a fetish item or a sign of wealth. This just traded hands. Obviously, there were no museums then, so this was just rich people, a rich people toy.
Buying it off one another, inheriting it from one another, a status symbol. You know, as money poured into the Netherlands from mercantilism and later the age of exploration and colonialism, people would have, the way you would express that would be with your collections.
Right.
You've got a map on the wall at the Far East that shows your how much stock you own in whatever trading company.
Sure, your private forest.
You've got fancy your seashells and stuffed armadillos and whatnot to show that you're a man of science and who is interested in the things of the far world. And you have beautiful art on your walls. And in some cases, the art would show religious devotion. Biblical scenes would have been very common back then. And even if the painting wasn't titled, people would obviously say, oh, this is the Temptation of St. Anthony, or this is Jesus and the, St. Matthew, the tax collector, or whatever it is. These scenes are unusual because even today, he's painting stuff with a theological underpinning, but we don't know what he's saying.
Oh, first of all, almost everyone is naked.
We are looking right now. Are you looking at the Garden of Earthly Delights?
Well, so I want to say you've spent quite a bit of time in Spain, as I have, and I'm assuming that you have also seen this painting in real life at the Prado Museum.
It is overwhelming to see in person. Have you seen it?
Yeah, I have.
So we've talked about the Prado before. I think I was talking about Goya's black paintings deep in the bowels of the Prado.
Right. Well, there's a couple Goya paintings that I keep very dear to my heart.
And bedside table. The Garden of Earthly Delights is a wooden triptych that's 7 feet tall.
Yeah.
And when fully opened and extended, 13 feet wide.
Yeah.
It's enormous. It's CinemaScope. And I believe it's displayed in the Prado in such a way that you can go around to the side and you can see that when it's closed, it has artwork on the outside as well.
Yeah.
It's a whole show. Like if you approach the Garden of Earthly Delights when it's closed, there's kind of a gray sphere floating in space. The whole thing is painted in monochrome. It's grisaille, a technique that doesn't use any pigments besides black and white. So there's a sphere floating in space, but it's kind of like a snow globe. There's a flat landscape kind of halfway up the sphere with very detailed vegetation and geographic features and terrain on it. And a little tiny god, the father, up in the upper left, I think with a scroll creating the world. So we're seeing the creation there.
And this is how it would have been displayed in a palace, closed, and then you would approach it and open it to discover its marvels?
I think so, because what you see when you open it is just eye-popping. You can see why he chose the black and white outside, because—
Look out, baby.
When it's opened, you now have three large panels, two kind of narrower rectangular ones, and a large square in the middle. The one on the left is a representation of the Garden of Eden.
Which it has a kind of traditional sort of like, here's Jesus and here are Adam and Eve in their nakedness.
Yes.
But
it appears that maybe they're not being cast out. Things are still good.
Yeah, it's a happy time.
They've just been created. You know, the Lord has appeared to say, hey, Adam, I've just turned your rib into this naked lady.
Hello.
You guys are married, which is what which is what all of us spend our lives waiting for.
But then there are these wonderful and fantastically drawn animals who are all living in Eden.
Some of which would have been, obviously a lot of them Bosch never would have seen. There's an elephant and a giraffe.
A very cool giraffe.
He's like an albino giraffe.
Yeah, and like—
apparently, Bosch had only seen black and white renderings of a giraffe.
My friend, the artist Scott Musgrove, draws fantastic, or rather paints fantastical animals and also aminals, and his aminals are derived from the aminals of Bosch.
Oh, really? They're kind of heightened and
I recommend to everyone skewed. That they explore the artwork of Scott Musgrove.
There's a unicorn at left drinking from the pool. The Eden, right. Eden has, you know, the lush vegetation and is just crawling with all manner of birds and beasts.
There's a cat eating a mouse.
Yeah, so there are a few places where it looks as if we're seeing foreshadowing of, you know, the post-Edenic paradise.
Yeah, dark pool.
The birds appear to be kind of squabbling in this dark pool in the foreground.
What is that, that creature that's climbing out of the pool? Is that a wombat or?
Yeah, it has like a dark roundish head. No, like the ears are very low though. It's opossum-like.
Yeah.
It's certainly nothing he would have seen in Europe. You know, there definitely seems to be some attempt to make these just fantastic creatures. And there's architecture too. Eden appears to have this very ornate pink fountain of life that's kind of stained glassy. It's reminiscent of maybe crustacean claws or maybe his idea of exotic Eastern, Middle Eastern architecture.
It looks like an H.R. Geiger thing, except it's pink.
Right.
Right?
What if we took all the genitalia stuff in H.R. Geiger art, but like really made it bright pink, so we foregrounded it. So you couldn't avoid thinking about it. And in the background, there's kind of these fantastic mountain shapes that are
caves and
they're swirly and kind of they look designed and artistic, not natural or formed by natural processes.
There's a flock of birds flying.
It's a murmuration.
Yeah,
they're coming out of like a bat cave type, a rectangular cave, and then they're swirling through other circular holes in the rock as they make their path skyward.
So even though this is Eden, it's already a pretty freaky place. I'm not sure the human figures are represented rather. Realistically for the time.
Yes.
They don't have big ears. They don't have wings.
Everything's very detailed. You know, the people have expressions. Adam's kind of looking up expectantly. Eve is naked, but she's looking kind of down at her knees demurely.
Maybe Adam is looking up expectantly like, do I get a second Eve? Like how many Eves?
And he's also not even standing. He's like, oh, cool. I have a helper now. I can just sit around on my ass on the grass in Eden forever now. Cool. Like parts of my body turn into naked ladies now.
She has very long hair. I'm not sure what Jesus is doing there because Jesus wouldn't have been there.
Right? Wait a second. This is like the goof section of IMDb. Jesus would not have been born until 0 AD. The Garden of Eden, as we all know, is 4004 BC.
That's right.
Jesus is time traveled here.
Oh, this is time travel Jesus.
Yeah, you remember.
Yeah, of course.
If he feeds more than 88 people from a single loaf of bread, he goes back in time.
This is one of the books of the Apocrypha, isn't it? like the Gospel of Judas.
Like we only have like, you know, a few thousand words of what Jesus said. What was he doing the rest of the time? He was going time back traveling. In time. What would you do if you had that kind of power? You'd want to see T-Rexes.
I would go to the United States, frankly.
You think should he have made a boat?
He did later.
He can walk on water. Just walk to Florida.
Yeah, come on. Come on, Jesus.
Walk across the Mediterranean and check out the swamps of the Eastern Seaboard.
Well, now here's a curious thing. Jesus is one of the only people in the whole painting wearing clothes.
Yeah, so you know, in the book of Genesis, of course, the Lord appears and gives Eve to Adam to wife.
Right.
And so he has painted.
To wife.
As we say in my fundamentalist
You're about fundamentalist to get upbringing. Wifed.
Big time, mister. But, you know, the Lord is, according to the theology of the time, Christ and God are one.
Oh, sure.
And so we're just seeing God, you know, he's been God, the old bearded father on the outside.
Right.
Now we're seeing him as Christ.
As the young son.
Walking in the garden. Should we do hell next?
Well, no, let's go to the main story.
The main event. So this is what's tricky. What is going on in the middle? So spoilers, the right-hand side is going to be hell. So we see at left, paradise, not just in our past, but also possibly our heavenly future, I guess, you know? And on the right, we see the tortures of the damned in hell. Very, very vividly described. When the hell is depicted on The Simpsons, it's generally a version of this painting.
There's a bird sitting on a throne eating a man.
So there's a bird eating a man.
Oh, so you do want to go to hell.
Go a couple pages later if you want to see a close-up of the bird. If you're not driving your flying cars, futurelings, look at the hell panel of the last judgment.
The bird has long humanoid legs that are in two urns.
Yes, his shoes are green ceramic urns for some reason. He's sitting on a large high bar stool, which is also a toilet.
Right. He's pooping people in a blue bubble.
Well, you see him. Yeah, so he eats some people.
Ugh.
He's eating a naked man who's...
There are birds flying out of his butt.
Yeah, so butts are huge, by the way, in all of Bosch's visions of the afterlife. Butts feature prominently. They're getting tortured. They're doing things that butts should not do in real life.
Oh, yeah, there's a guy playing a flute out of his butt over there.
There's a guy playing a flute out of his butt. In the main panel, we're going to see a youth placing flowers into the butt of another man bending over next to him.
The bird is wearing an iron cauldron for a hat.
Yes, and for that reason, he's often called like the king of hell or the prince of hell. Like it's a parody of a crown or the crown that God might have in heaven.
Oh, I see.
Like maybe this is the prince of darkness himself.
Oh, look above him. There's someone on ice skates, like real ice skates.
Yes, hell is very cold here. You know, there are boats moving in the waterways of hell, the rivers of hell, the Styx or whatever it is. But there's a weird kind of... needle-nosed dolphin sloth monkey guy.
Right.
Holding a bow, maybe? And bows and arrows.
Yes.
And he's got ice skates. He's skating on the ices of hell. So even though there's distant fires and military campaigns and ruined cities off in the distance, apparently hell is also not just hot, but cold. Getting back to the pooping guy, notice that the naked person he's eating, the guy's butt appears to be exploding in some kind of incendiary fart, sending out sparks and black smoke and a flock of birds.
Flock of black birds.
And then the people he eats are then defecated out in a blue bubble into his throne. And then they fall into a pit in which a figure is pooping gold coins.
Yes, there's someone else barfing.
Yes, someone else is barfing. There's a lot of defecation and egestion of food. He's very interested in, if you're thinking about what unpleasant things might happen in hell.
That seems unpleasant.
Poop is unpleasant.
So, although, I don't know, if I could poop gold coins, I might visit hell.
Where are you going to spend them, John?
Oh, right, in the poop hole.
Does hell have a mall? We don't even know.
But the central figure of hell is the really hard to parse male torso that looks like it's kind of made of wood, except his arms are in boats.
He has no legs. His arms are in boats, so he's on the water, and they appear to be trees with branches.
Trees with branches, and then you can see inside his torso. It's like he's been chopped in half at the waist.
He's gone through an egg cracking machine. He's hollow.
He's looking back, sort of passively over his shoulder,
and wearing a weird platter on his head on which creatures cavort.
Well, and that looks like a bagpipe.
So there's not only a giant pink bagpipe thing on his head, but also a flag with the same symbol coming out of his torso. Do you see the small bagpipe on a flag?
Oh, yeah.
And I think there's a lot of speculation that bagpipes back then were very funny to people as phallic symbols.
Oh.
It reminds you of genitalia.
Doesn't really, but yeah, okay. I mean, if your testicles were huge and your penis was small... Which I don't think is, maybe that's what's maybe funny about it.
This is revealing a little too much about Hieronymus Bosch, I guess. Honestly, the tree man is often said to be a self-portrait. We have one self-portrait of an older Bosch that looks quite a bit like this. The pale man is a...
What's all going on inside his body?
There is some kind of a tavern scene. I mean, you'd think hell would not have a club scene, but there is a table with people sitting around, yeah, waiting for the beat to drop. They have, I think it looks like they have drinks to me, and there is somebody's filling a barrel at left, but they are not happy.
No.
They're in a pub, but they are bummed.
Well, if you've ever really spent that much time in pubs, you will know.
It's a realistic British pub, I think.
But then the one other really large, although there are tons and tons of little scenes, if you can spend hours looking at, there's someone crucified on a harp.
So there's a lot of musical symbols.
Horns and drums,
which might suggest kind of the cacophony of hell. Think how loud this must be.
Sure, it's like being at a guitar center on a Saturday.
No stairway. Or it might be that this is what we're seeing is an inversion of all the sensory pleasures of earth. They've all turned bad. Like here, we love to hear a beautiful harp, but guess what? In hell, you're going to get crucified on a harp. Because you know, look at this choir. They're all below this giant.
There's a metronome.
There is a huge metronome. A lot of surrealism, oversized body parts and objects like shoes turned into boats and metronomes the size of
houses. Can you imagine a more hellish thing than a huge metronome? Just tick, tick, tick.
It's coming back.
Forever. Just tick,
tick, tick. It's like Chinese water torture.
You would never, ever, ever get used to it.
Look how this choir or band or whatever it is. For one thing, there's a guy inside the drum. So he's having right. a really, there's a guy in the bass drum having right. a bad time of it.
That's a bad time.
And the other people are having to read music that's been apparently tattooed on someone's butt. Do you see below the green lute?
They're trying to figure out how the lute part
goes. So it's like you're in a band, but check it out.
Yeah.
The sheet music's a butt.
As a musician,
John, you can tell how awful that would be.
Do they flat the third? We have to look inside his butt to find out.
And there's a lot of other kind of ironic punishments like that going on. Bach's Visions of Hell are inspired by this medieval genre of like a travelogue through hell. You know, people would claim to have these visions. Dante is the only one that's really survived in popular
culture.
So
is this post-Dante or pre-Dante?
It's around the same time, and there's no evidence whether or not he ever read Dante. But we know he read the Visions of Tundale, an Irish knight who kind of describes a similar voyage through heaven and then the purgatory and then hell.
How do we know that? Is it the butt trumpets or what is, or?
Tundale is always talking about butts. The one thing I remember of hell, and I quiver to think of it, it's full of butts. We know that because he actually painted a version of, you know, a vision of Tundale that's recognizable. Oh. And Tundale, I think, invented this modern idea of ironic hell. Like the sins that you loved will just be revisited on you Twilight Zone style. Like in the lower left, we see a gambler at a gaming table, but like the cards are strewn everywhere and he's just been knifed to the table. He's got a knife through his palm and the game is not going well. This, you know, a woman is torturing him with dice on her head. And religious hypocrisy seems to be being called out here. Like there's which is kind of daring, you'd think it at is. The time. Maybe this is the Protestant Reformation starting to rear its head, but there's a pig in a nun's habit in lower right.
Yep.
Do you see
yep.
her or it? Trying to get this guy to sign, she's got a quote, she's trying to get this guy to sign a document. And the usual interpretation is she's trying to get him to sign over his earthly goods to the church and thereby save his soul.
Oh, yes.
Which has apparently, spoilers, been ineffective since he's in hell.
He's already in hell, and he's contracting with a nun pig.
The pig nun is still after him.
And what is going on with the two giant ears with a knife through them?
Yeah, I think, so everybody talks about that M on the knife. Like, what does the M stand for? You know, people are very into possible symbology.
I feel like in this case, they're not wrong to be seeking some symbology.
No, this is not conspiracy theory. Many mainstream studies of Bosch's work focuses on, you know, what kind of alchemical or astrological symbolism is going on here? Are there secret societies of his time being referred to? And so the M was much commented on. You know, it could just be in line with the guy on the harp, you know, like the cacophony of hell is such that it's a knife through your ears. But recently, I think an M like that has been found on a local Sertogenbosch knife from that period.
Oh, so it's just a maker's mark?
Yeah. And so he was just accurately depicting in amazing detail. You know, look at the metronome. Yeah. Look at these people that live in this little lamp at right. You know, the objects of his desktop in incredible, super surreal, today we'd call it hyperrealism, detail, but they're a weird size. They're interacting with the damned in ominous ways. What else? Oh, there's this, you know, lust. All the seven sins are condemned. You know, a lot of gluttony is condemned with all the barfing.
Right.
We got this gambler, the guy in the drum. Lust is condemned with this woman sitting at the feet of the Prince of Hell, who is looking at her mirror. Maybe she's narcissistic. She's an attractive naked woman looking at a mirror, but the mirror is somebody's butt.
Oh, that'll get you every time. Now, I remember being exposed to this. Maybe, you know, this is kind of an example of how Western art is, at least in our lifetimes, was presented to young people as like, here's our, you know, here's our patrimony. This is our
the 15 things you should know.
Yeah, this is Western culture. Yeah. Dig it. It's the fact that this painting is full of like horrors and lots of like people eating poop and stuff. It's fine for you to look at this when you're 12 years old because it's art.
I think the assumption may be that you cannot actually get a 12-year-old to pay close enough attention to art.
Right.
I mean, if it's a big naked lady front and center, you can see, you know, a fifth grader kind of raising an eyebrow.
But I wonder if at the time this was regarded as a humorous work, whether the court of Philip III would sit and go, ha ha, look at this guy.
Check out what happened to him.
Because it was a time when there was a lot more, there were a lot more people being eviscerated in the public square. I think there was a lot more connection to poop and viscera and death because it was, you know, we live in a time, futurelings, where those things are mostly hidden from us.
They've been abstracted away from middle-class people.
Yeah, we have doors that we close. I mean, Ken, have you seen a dead body?
Only, you know, embalmed and at a viewing.
At a funeral?
Yes.
How many?
Two or three.
Yeah. I mean, I was with my dad when he died. The only other dead person I ever saw, because I don't come from a culture of open casket funerals, by the time...
Because you guys are always mauled by grizzly bears.
Yeah, that's right. By the time the funeral happens, there's always a like an easel with a sign that says, we think he's dead. But in the case... I hope
you guys reuse the sign if that comes up a lot.
He was last seen...
it's a map. Somewhere in this radius...
But I was with my dad when he died, and he was really the first person that I ever saw who was died. There was one time I stepped over a guy who was in a doorway. This was back when cities were seedy in a different way.
It might come back. We might just be in an interregnum of Disneyfied city centers.
But I stepped over a guy, and as I was stepping, because he was just like passed out on the sidewalk, as I was stepping over him, I got a, oh my God, he's dead. Like I could just feel that he was dead. But I had somewhere to be. I had some drugs to buy. And so I kept going, and I came back about 15 minutes later, and they were loading him sheet over his head.
So, you were right.
So my crazy feeling was confirmed. Which was another example of like, huh, that's spooky action at a distance. But I wonder if in this era you could look at this painting and not, obviously it's a vision of hell, but also there are a lot of jokes in it.
Yeah, I think it is the kind of thing that you would pay big money for because it's Where's Waldo for your, or it's binge watching. Like you get a full season of incident.
Right.
Just by looking at this. And obviously you're right, in an age like that where death is always close at hand, it does explain why people are thinking of heaven and hell and wanting to read tours and travelogues of them, because it's the way you and I would think about, maybe I'll retire to Taos in New Mexico, or maybe I'll buy this new house. Look at these pictures, you know, like
right. This
might be the next place you live.
But Eden on one side and hell on the other, those are both small panels relative to the central panel.
Yes. And theologically, they're not confusing.
No,
you know?
No.
Good. Everything was good and pure in Eden. Everything's going to be bad if you're not saved and go to hell. In the middle, there's this lush parkland, which gives the painting its modern name, in which, again, many nude people are cavorting.
It is 100% orgiastic.
Hundreds and hundreds of figures, all naked. And you don't see outright intercourse going on, but...
Pretty close.
Pretty close. Look at these two people in the mussel shell. A guy's carrying a giant mussel shell. Shellfish, often a symbol for... arousal and genitalia.
Yeah.
Do you see this to the, It's in the bottom quarter of the painting, kind of below the floating peach.
Yes.
There's two people in there toe to toe, clearly naked. The butt coming toward you might have something coming out of the butt. Is there a bubble or a gem coming out of the butt?
Maybe. Old gem butt, they call him.
he's having a good time in his shell.
There are people riding mystical animals. There's someone riding a griffin. There are people riding pigs and goats.
The men are riding these animals around a central pond wherein like kind of nude
nymphs.
Sirens. Yeah. Nymphs kind of, you know, wink coquettishly at them. So riding a big muscular animal that you've mounted is probably sexual in context.
Big herds of men riding horses. They're often carrying fishes.
The pleasures just don't end. There's giant fish and giant strawberries that people are just taking big bites out of.
No one is having a bad time. Even there are a couple of people who are dancing with a giant owl on their heads. There's a guy with a blueberry for a head, but yeah, they don't seem unhappy.
No, there are the people. The owl guy is waving some kind of floral castanets or something. Those are berries, maybe. He's waving giant berries.
There are a lot of fish, which I guess in the Netherlands would be like, yeah, of course you're going to be like, fish.
The birds and fish are all kind of human-sized, which makes it it really looks like a modern surrealist canvas, you know, this kind of mall fantasy art where giant fish are swimming by this kind of Maxfield Parrish looking city.
Camels and ibexes.
You know, and again, more of this kind of Edenic architecture in the background, kind of a maybe an orientalized Dutch guy's view of what the cities of India or Far Cathay or Arabia, Baghdad might look like.
There's one Nubian woman who is painted with a sort of carbon cinder color.
Yes, someone who has never seen a black person, just like never seeing a giraffe. There's a few. There's another.
She has an apple on her head.
There's another black person at lower right, also with kind of a weird cherry thing. Oh, sure.
So there's
on
a,
his head.
He's a man, and his counterpart female is on the other side.
So all these white people are probably going to hook him up. They're going to be like, "Oh, I have a black friend. He's over at lower right."
Well, you know, I don't see color. They would be like, "I'm wearing an apple on my head. Do you know anyone else with an apple?"
It's the kind
on
of thing
head?
Where you're I'm describing this figure to you, and I'm like. Cherry on his head. You know, I have to say three things, and then I'm like, oh, and they're black.
You know the guy. He's the one with the cherry on his head.
Once you said three or four things, then you can be like, oh, as an afterthought, oh, he's African-American.
He's tall. He's very athletic.
There's a white man kissing a black woman on the mallard's back.
Where's in the pool, mallard?
In the pool, far oh, left. Pool. Over in bird country.
Oh, yeah. There are a couple of owls
there's
over
some,
there,
There's
too.
Some hot interracial love
well,
over there.
Now that I'm looking more carefully, there are a couple of dark-skinned nymphs, maybe more than
Oh, yeah, in the fountain. You're right.
So he is trying to...
He is saying this is humanity.
He's trying to be representative.
There's no black people in hell, apparently, which is nice.
I don't see any Asian people, but maybe he wouldn't even be aware.
Yes.
Of Asia.
I think you're
No turbans.
Right.
Are there turbans?
Well, nobody's wearing anything.
Oh, right.
all the headgear is like, now, here, you put on an owl. We're right. ready to go.
Put
we're ready
a,
to go.
Put a fish on your head.
Put a big fish on your
so
head.
So now, let me ask, since you seem to know the interpretation of this painting, this doesn't really seem like the Earth I know.
You've never been here?
So in between heaven and hell, this is...
So yeah, a typical view would have... Eden on one side, hell on the other, and maybe you know, our current time in the middle, or you know, a biblical scene between the two, or maybe the last judgment where the Christ is separating out the sheep from the goats.
Right, or something that is like suggests a linear passage
yes,
through time.
But what is going on here? Theologically, it's very confusing to us. And maybe there would have been notes, but maybe the fact that there's no other works like this means that maybe it would have seemed just as eccentric to a viewer back then. Maybe Bosch was just always being like, no, you gotta, it's all about symbolism, man.
But are these people sinning or are they acting in a spirit of innocence?
Right. There's a bunch of readings of this and they kind of revolve around that central disagreement. Like, are we supposed to think these guys are bad? Look at this awful orgy they're having. This is a cautionary tale.
Right. This is a clear-eyed view of what civilization really is, which is a bunch of naked fish wearing.
This pleasure garden is the worst that our fallen world has to offer.
Or?
I mean, if he's saying that, he's really made it look really fun and attractive. Although,
he does, yes.
Although hell also kind of is fun in a way, so maybe his views are not...
Quite a bit less pooping in Earth.
Or is it possible that this is some kind of innocent fantasy world? Are
right,
we
before
seeing,
the fall.
Yeah. I mean, we already have Eden before the fall, but is this some like parallel how things could be? Like this is... Maybe if Adam and Eve had never fallen, what if we were in this kind of innocent, pleasant land?
It's interesting because in the Eden scene, where you would normally find an apple tree... as the symbol of the impending fall. In this painting, you see a palm tree and no fruit.
So the kind of the exotic plants are lead to an interesting reading of this whole triptych. We don't know what order he painted his stuff in. None of his 25 or 30 extant works are dated. So we just have to use supposition to guess when he painted each one.
Right.
This one has a pineapple, which is a New World fruit. So it therefore must come after 1492. Clearly, this is from the latter half of his career. And a lot of people who have looked at this kind of idyllic parallel world in the middle are wondering if the discovery of the New World has influenced Bosch. Like,
oh, this is the New World.
There's a whole innocent continent out there that doesn't have our troubles and our, you know, our fallen nature and our religious... Wars and dumb Kevin pooping in the lake, but it actually has you know, this gorgeous architecture and animals we've never seen, delightful physical sensory pleasures of all kinds.
100% in the spirit of its time. The 15th century, 16th century, people at the dawn would have been wondering, like, because Columbus comes back and says, well, they don't, there aren't a lot of clothes.
Right.
And they do crazy things.
And people are like, yeah.
And people are like, well, let me get to the cities where there are big pink bagpipes.
People want their big golden cities encrusted with jewels where these, you know, noble savages live in their Edenic, clothesless life.
So is there, what do we learn from this? What do futurelings take away? I mean, I think of this. This is what I imagine their world looks like.
They could build the society. They could... I mean, maybe what they should learn is to, like, leave notes on your paintings so people aren't all like, wait, are these the good guys or the bad guys? Sometimes I just think, like, I mean, clearly you're seeing Bosch's brain. Like, this was fun for him to draw. Like, he liked drawing all these little torso-less frogs with owl heads wiggling around hell. And so he was not troubled by things like theology or composition. He just wanted to paint fun stuff. It's the same impulse that leads to... you know, the world building in modern prestige TV or epic fantasy.
Like, it's funny that you say fun to draw, because I always read it as a torture.
Cautionary tale.
Well, no, that he was tortured.
Oh, and, because like he's a weird guy.
These drawings are so, you know, when you think about outsider art as a modern phenomenon, most of the time the people are not recognized in their day and are drawing fantastical figures out of a form of torment.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's the lesson of Garden of Earthly Delights, is if you're seeing this kind of stuff, please tell your therapist to up your dosage.
And that concludes The Garden of Earthly Delights, entry 515.SS0611, certificate number 17086 in the omnibus. Futurelings, we sincerely hope that social media has evaporated into the hot gas from which it's made.
Maybe it's been cast down into a Boschian hell.
Right. Maybe social media is inside of a bird being eaten by a clam.
Yeah, I hope Mark Zuckerberg is getting pooped into a big blue bubble right now.
But in the unlikely event that it survives, please check us out at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick on Twitter. Don't just check us out. Follow us. And in particular, follow me, because Ken has more followers than I do, and it's insulting.
I am, by the time futurelings hear this, even if they listen to it immediately, I will probably be in the rare 7,300 club. That's people on Twitter who have 70 Jeopardy wins and 300,000 followers. It's not a huge club.
I hate you in a way. also, you can find our shows archived at Omnibus Project. You can check out my sexy Instagram account under my name. Also, you can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can visit us on Facebook at the Omnibus Futurelings fan group, and you can mail us great big apple hats at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155.
Listeners, from our vantage point in what is to you the distant past, we have no idea how things are going to turn out, if it'll be a verdant earthly paradise with people boning inside giant oysters, or if it will be a burning, ruined hellscape with a giant metronome about to pound down on your head at any second.
Tick, tick,
that's
tick.
Awesome. You should keep doing that to make it more hellish. Tick, tick. We hope and pray that the catastrophe that comes, the comet or whatever, will hold off. But if it comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, could be our final word to you. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.